We are welcoming a new show to iHeart and the DraftKings YouTube channel. It is called Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano. It is an insider look at the NBA and the coaches surrounding the league. Every week, the five-time All-Star and the number one pick in the 2010 NBA Draft, John Wall, will give his unique perspective on hot topics in the league and tell the best behind-the-scenes stories from his time in the NBA. So check out Point Game with John Wall and CJ Toledano on the iHeartRadio app, the DraftKings YouTube channel, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The hit movie Bob Marley, One Love, is now streaming on Paramount+. Celebrate the life and music of an icon who inspired generations through his message of love, peace, and unity. If you missed Bob Marley, One Love in the theaters, now's your chance to watch at home. Stream the hit movie now on Paramount+, rated PG-13. Head to ParamountPlus.com/OneLove to try it free now.
State Farm Insurance knows that understanding and investing in our cultural identity is paramount in protecting our future. We know what it's like to go from nothing to something, to wish that we had better financial literacy when we were younger. Luckily, State Farm is here to help with funding programs like Project Ready, which is committed to education achievement and has already awarded over $11 million in scholarship offers to Black and Brown youth since 2021. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
What's good, everybody? It's our favorite time of the year here at the Black Effect. We're headed down to Atlanta for the 2024 Black Effect Podcast Festival, and we're not going alone. Nissan is back as our partner, and they're continuing their Pitch Your Podcast Lounge at the festival, where you'll have the opportunity to pitch your podcast idea live and share it with the Black Effect team. So get those podcast ideas ready. And remember, you can count on Nissan to dial up the thrill in your adventures, no matter where life takes you. Visit blackeffect.com/podcastfestival for more details.
Got my Prevnar 20 shot. It's a pneumococcal pneumonia vaccine. For us, wise folks, it helps protect.
I'm 19, strong.
And asthmatic, and at higher risk? Get vaccinated.
But
nothing when grandma speaks.
Grandson listens.
19 or older with chronic conditions like asthma, diabetes, or chronic heart disease, or 65 plus, you may be at higher risk for pneumococcal pneumonia. Prevnar 20 can help protect you with just one dose.
Prevnar 20 is approved for adults to help prevent infections from 20 strains of the bacteria that cause pneumococcal pneumonia. Continued approval may depend on a supportive study. Don't get Prevnar 20 if you've had a severe allergic reaction to the vaccine or its ingredients. Adults with weakened immune systems may have a lower response to the vaccine. Side effects include pain and swelling at the injection site, fatigue, headache, muscle, and joint pain. For full prescribing information, please call 1-855-213-2138 or visit Prevnar 20.com.
Ask your doctor or pharmacist about getting vaccinated with Prevnar 20, even if you've already received another pneumococcal pneumonia vaccine.
Wake that ass up
early in the morning.
The Breakfast Club.
Morning, everybody. It's DJ Envy, Angela Yee, Charlamagne Tha God. We are the Breakfast Club. We got a special guest in the building.
Hello,
Primo,
there.
DJ Premier.
What's up? What's up?
Welcome back.
Thanks for having me back again.
Of course.
I think this is the third time.
Third time. You got a new project, Hip Hop 50.
Yeah, it's
tell us about it.
It's Mass Appeal, the label. Obviously, you know, Peter Bittenbender and Nas, business partners, and they approached me about this 10 producer EP where the 1 through 9 are producers that they chose to do an EP that contains 5 songs. And the 9th one is going to be voted by the fans. So they'll get to say, this is who we want to do the 10th one. The 10th one's going to land on the 50th anniversary of hip hop, which is August 11th, you know, 1973 is the official birthday. So when the 10th one drops, it'll be on the 50th birthday. So we don't know who that's going to be, since I guess they'll probably wait till they get closer to the end to let the fans choose. So like every 2 to 3 months, sort of, it'll be another one released. I think Swiss is next.
Swiss is the next one.
Yeah,
it only makes sense. You, Nas, you know, for you to kick things off.
Yeah, well, I was like, we get to pick who we want. So I was like, Nas, you got to give me one. I know you're part of the company, but you got to give me at least one, and I'll figure out the other 4.
You got like an all-star cast for these 5 songs, too, because you kicked it off with Joey Badass.
Yeah.
Which I love. He's from Brooklyn.
Love Joey, man. Badman.
And then, of course, you put Remy Ma and Rhapsody together, which was a great matchup.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then I love this song with Slick Rick and Lil Wayne, too.
Yeah, yeah. That was a last-minute thing, but the dope part was Wayne had already laid his verse, so when I told Rick about it, and you know Rick, let me hear the verse, see what he said. You know, he talks just like the way, like the children's story record, and I was like, as soon as he heard it, he's like, oh, yeah. He said, do you want a hook or do you want a verse or do you want a verse and a hook? I was like, I want both. And he said, all right, I'll do both of them.
And Run the Jewels. How long did it take him to do it? So those are the five songs.
He did it maybe in like 2 or 3 days.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's interesting to me because I feel like you have such a long history also in this game. You're from Houston, mm-hmm. but then you moved to New York.
By way of Prairie View. A lot of times it's left out, even though born in Fifth Ward and lived there and we moved to, my father was a biology teacher at Prairie View, mm-hmm. and that's how nice. We ended up moving there because he wanted to be closer to the college, which is only like a 40-minute drive. So he built a house in that town, and that's how my family moved from Fifth Ward to PV. And I went to college there, too. Didn't graduate.
And then you moved to New York.
Yes.
Now, why did you move to New York?
My grandfather lived in Brooklyn, and my mother, which is his father, is from Baltimore.
Okay.
So every summer, my after school, was like, oh, we're going to New York for the summer. And, you know, as kids, we're like, yay, we're going to New York. So we'd always, and my father's from South Carolina, she's from Baltimore, so we always stop in South Carolina and Sumter, see my family there, which is the Martin family. Then we go to North Carolina to see our aunt and my uncle. Then we go to, and that's driving. Mm-hmm. Then we go to Baltimore, see my grandmother and my aunt and my cousin. Then New York is the finale. So we always stay with my grandfather Bill, who's tatted on my arm because he was a major part of me wanting to be in the music business.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in bands and stuff. He used to brag and show me his photo albums of all the places he'd been. And mm-hmm. I was just really into that. And I was really into video. I guess you can't really call them video games in my age since I'm 56. I was a pinball expert. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that's not video game. Yeah. But what do you call it?
You don't call that video game,
yeah,
right?
What do you call it? I don't know.
Arcade games.
So I was always battling people in pinball. So whenever I'd go to stay with my grandfather, and this is right before I was like maybe 11 or 12, because as I got older and like turned 13, 14, my sisters and them didn't want to go anymore. They're like, we want to have summer with our friends and I'm going to keep going to New York. Me, I wanted to go because he was into baseball. We would go to baseball games. That's how I got into the Yankees, even though I'm still a diehard Astros fan for life. I'm Houston everything for life on that. But when it came to my grandfather, we would always go to Playland in Times Square, and he'd give me mad rolls of quarters, and I would just battle people in pinball, say, I'll play you. And I just love the whole action of the city. And being that he went to, I was in Tokyo, I was here, and he's showing all these pictures. I was like, man, I want to do that one day. One day he takes me to Playland, and we see some B-boys breaking and stuff. You know how they put the guitar case open to put money in?
Yep, yep, yep.
You put your quarters in?
Yeah. Well, just seeing all, you know, I didn't know what breakdancing was, and just seeing all that, and they playing the hip-hop, and they got the big boom box, and I was like, this is different because growing up in my era, we liked our parents' music. You know, now as, mm-hmm. you know, my son is 11, he's not really into the music I'm into because the generation is different. But for us, we were into Gladys Knight and, you know, Curtis Mayfield, Barry White, you know, the Temptations. We weren't like, that's your old folks' music. We all grew liking our parents' music.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Until Prince comes out and, you know, the Confunction and, you know, Cameo. And we start to kind of, my mom was like, that's y'all's music. And we separate. But when I saw them doing all that breakdancing in Times Square, I was like, I want to move here.
Mm.
And then as it built and hip hop started to grow and then records started coming out, I was like, man, that's me. I could just totally identify. And I was like, this is what I want
to
do.
Did you listen to disco too? Did your parents listen to that?
Yeah. Yeah, that was even that. I mean, you as a DJ, mm-hmm. the 12-inch single, I mean, to get hit Rapper's Delight or anything like that, you had to only buy a 12-inch.
Mm-hmm.
There weren't no cassette singles yet. There was no CDs. Mm-hmm. You would even if you didn't have a turntable, you bought the record just to say, I own Rapper's Delight, you know.
Well, so. we had turntable. It wasn't 1200s, but we always had a turntable at the crib.
Yeah, when DJing at home.
Mom always had a turntable at the crib.
That's me in the basement listening to, I used to put my headphones in and just listen to records on the turntable all day.
Yeah, so even with that, as it grew, I was like, man, I'm going to move here. So in 87, I started to make my move, and I was still staying with my grandfather. Then he passed. Once he passed, I moved in with one of my classmates' parents who went to Prairie View with us. They were from Brooklyn, and that's how I ended up in East New York, really deep in the hood and hanging around all these wild guys. And then you kind of start to blend in and become part of them. Some of them were just wild and crazy. I loved the action being from a smaller town. And then, you know, I ran the streets, did all the crazy stuff, but not to the degree of where it would get back to my father finally now that I was doing stuff.
So it was like a gumbo of music. You had your taste from Houston and South Carolina and North Carolina and Maryland and
heavy metal. I remember seeing somewhere that you used to listen to heavy metal.
I still do. I love rock. I love jazz. And my mother's an art teacher, so she taught all of us art. And because of that, that's another reason why I was into vinyl, because she had so many different types of records. And then me and her would go record shopping, and we went to concerts together. You know, so anything that had to go to concerts, my mother and I would always go. We'd go see Shaka. It was Rufus at the time, featuring Shaka Khan. Our whole family went to see Ike and Tina Turner, and I was
amazing.
And I got lost. You know how you in your seats, but if you go in, there's always an aisle that separates each row.
Yep.
I'm dancing, doing my thing. I kind of move to the left, and you know they're not looking. They're watching the show. And as I drift out of the aisle that takes the stairs all the way down to the bottom row of that section, I ended up in the wrong one. So now I'm looking like...
You cried.
Yeah.
I remember the first time I lost my mom in TSS. Boy, did I cry.
Yeah, you got me.
I used to get lost all the time, but like on purpose, and I never was upset about it.
What?
And then my parents would be going crazy looking for me.
I would be crying.
And then next you know, I show up with a cop bringing me.
Yep.
And then they feel irresponsible.
Janet Casey, your son is here. We have your son.
That's what happened. Hey, the crazy thing is, you know, the usher's like, "Where you don't know?" And I'm like, "No, okay, Papa Bobby." And they had to go make an announcement to Tina. So they stopped the music and they go, "We have a little boy lost."
On stage?
Yes.
So Tina Turner knows you.
Had to make the announcement.
This little boy lost, messing up my
and
show.
They found me and my mother's boy, you get it when you get home. My mother was the disciplinarian. My father was the extra disciplinarian, but my mom was the one that taught me how to throw my hands up if I got into a fight, everything. So
go get your shoes. We got to fight.
Yeah, yeah. So I learned early, you know, to be a stand-up guy because of my mom. And on top of that, don't you move out of that aisle no more when you're at a concert. So shout to Ike and Tina.
Have you seen that challenge going around? The challenge with the parents are telling their kids, "Go get your shoes."
Now
it's funny. A lot of people saying is disrespectful, right?
Yep.
But I'll be honest. That's what I teach my kids. I teach my kids, if mom or dad or your brother, sister have a problem, you put your shoes on and you got to help your family.
Yeah.
So it's like, I tested one of my kids the other day and, you know, he was like, "All right, put my shoes." He's like, "All right, we got a problem, Dad. Let's go." But that's what you want. Dope. That's what my dad taught me.
Hey, it's traumatizing for the kids who start crying and then they're posted on social media forever.
They wasn't crying.
I literally just saw it just flashing the TV and TMZ was on and they were showing Donnell Rollins asking his son to do it. And even though he walked off and went back, they went like at the airport, it seemed like, and he walks back in like, "I'm not doing it," or whatever. And then they show the people on, you know, the staff on TMZ, and the girl was going, "That's wrong." And she was like, "That you shouldn't do that." And, you know, with the whole energy of like, "That's not cool." But Donnell did it, and his son was like, "Yo, I'm sticking with my pops," though. When he walked off, he thought he was going to run, but he stayed there, you know. So I'm sure Donnell's teaching.
But that's what my dad taught me. My dad worked a lot, and he always told me, if something happens with your mom, you have her back. You make sure she's good. If I'm not here, and same thing with my grandmother. I stayed with my grandmother the whole summer, and my cousins, they always taught, if y'all get beat up, if one get a black eye, y'all all better have a black eye.
And plus, Donnell's son, Austin, probably is going to have to protect him one day soon, because I don't know if y'all seen Donnell fight, but...
No, I haven't.
So let's get back into your story, though. So you're in Brooklyn, right?
Yeah.
And so the first artist that you produced for, was it for Gangstar, for Guru?
Gangstar, as far as joining the group, I was in a group called, we used to be called MCs in Control. It was my man Topski, Sugar Pop, and Stylie T. Stylie
Great
T
names.
He was our like Flavor Flav of the group. This is all college buddies from school. And as it got to the point where we wanted to see if we could make it in New York, the only ones that could really afford to go was me and Top, because Top happened to be from Boston, so he would always go visit his pops. The reason why he was in Houston is because his mother lived in Mo City, which is, if anybody in Texas knows, that's Missouri City, but we call it Mo City. So we would always go to her house during the summer, or we'd be up in New York. When I was trying to shop my demo, I was working at a record store in Houston called Soundways. It was the store in the hood that everybody, the pimps would come to. They'd come in there with the gators and the hat cocked, they's deuce, and just, you know, with the gold, one gold tooth going, "Hey, man, you got that Lattimore?" Mm-hmm. You know, they don't even say Lattimore. They say Lattimore. and you had to know every genre of music, and you had to know Zydeco music, which, you know, is you know, the Cajun music with the kind of the accordion sound.
Oh, I definitely didn't.
It's big down there. Look up Zydeco. It's super big. It's like very New Orleans, but it Texas is big. And it's very heavy out there. Everybody knows the words to everything. Like a Before I Let Go from Maze, they know the words to every Zydeco record. So we grew up with that. The boss at the store said you have to know all that, including country as well and jazz. So I had a good knowledge of it because of my mother's record collection. And as that built, I was telling the guy that got me the job. His name is Carlos Garza. He's a big part of me getting here because hip hop was just going on Billboard. They were having finally had a hip hop chart. Mm-hmm. He became the Billboard reporter, so he had me become the 12-inch buyer for all the 12-inch records that come in. So that he could occupy that, and they're checking, hey, what's popping in Houston? Oh, this record, and a lot of independent hip hop would call to get on that chart by having him report from Houston. While he was doing that, he's like, yo, man, you gotta check out this friend of mine. He could DJ, he's dope, and he's coming to New York for the summer. Stu Fine, who owned Wild Pitch Records, which Gangstar was on at that time, was like, hey, we want to hear the demo. I wasn't ready for him to hear it. He sent them a copy of it, and I was like, why'd you do that? It's not ready yet. And they heard it, and they liked it. But they didn't want them. They only wanted me. And I was like, well, I'm not going to go without my group, because I was not even contemplating being in a group. But I DJed all the parties at school. So everybody was like, yo, you should do it. Finally got my courage up to say, all right, we get to New York. He's like, I don't like your MC, but I'll put you in a real studio and let's see if you can do a better demo that, and maybe I'll like him and we're interested in signing you. They put us in the studio, still didn't like it. Top was like, yo, man, if things don't work out in the next couple of months, I'm going to join the military. And Top's a wild dude. I'm like, you ain't joining no military. That's not even your style. You too street for that. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to do it. One day when it was a weekend and we're all living at my man Gordon Franklin's parents' house, he made us get jobs, everything. He said, you can't stay. And they're all trendy, so you know. Mm-hmm. You have to have a job. And he said, you can't stay here, man. You know, so and only we couldn't come until like up to 5. So, you know, we get home at night from having to stay there. And I mean, we get home at night and then we got to stay out until he gets back from work, so we have nowhere to go. So I was like, I can't keep doing this. That one Saturday, when we're chilling, the doorbell rings, and the recruiting officer's in the outfit.
Wow.
He goes, hey, how you doing? We're looking for Theodore Campbell. And I was like, for what? He goes, oh, today is the day. He's joining the Navy. And I'm like, no way. And I'm like yelling down the basement, yo, Top. And he comes up the stairs like, yo, man, I told you. You know, they're not interested in us. I'm gone. And I'm like, how long are you gone for? He said 4 years.
Wow.
I'm like, oh, I'm not waiting. If he had said a year, I 100% was going to wait. He said 4 years. I'm like, dude. He said, nah, do your thing. I'm riding with you. He's my boy to this very day. We talk all the time, bug out. And next thing you know, he's gone. I called back to Stu and said, yo, Top just went. The recruiting officer just took him. He's like, so will you join Gangstar? And I was like, yeah. And that's how I became the DJ. Me and Guru started just talking on the phone because I had to go back to school to get another semester in. I made him a beat to Words I Manifest and said, I think this would be dope for you to rhyme over. He called me back and said, yo, I just wrote a rhyme. Check it out. And he's like, I'm professing. I don't jazz for the words I mean. I was like, ooh. Because they were already, Gangstar was already out. And I was a fan of some of their 12-inch singles when 45 King was producing them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then from there, you know, and then I was a fan of Latif, who was on Wild Pitch as well, who is Apache's brother. And Latif was one of the first, and Chill Rob G. So all of that, and that was all 45 King Flavor Unit stuff. Guru was the only outsider that was on that label at the time. And I was like, man, this could work. We recorded the record. Stu calls me back and is like, yo, it's popping on radio. Everybody's playing it. He said, but your version on the album is a little too slow. We need to make a more amped, maybe speed it up. I flew back there right before Thanksgiving, recorded the record, and did the extended one, which everybody knows from the video. He said, we're doing a video. And back then, you're like, I'm going to be in a video.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And we shot the video, and then it just really took off.
How was the money for you back then in deals that you signed? Was it
zero broke, you know? And after we made a name for ourselves, then Guru used to listen to all the demos. So he would go to Stu's house. It was a husband and wife label. and he'd have the shoebox of tapes. And when he heard my demo, the second demo he found was Lord Finesse. Mm. And Lord Finesse's demo, he's like, yo, I'm trying to talk to Stu into signing this guy. Lord Finesse, tell me what you think. I just found Lord Finesse's demo that he played me. And I got my demo back from Stu. He gave me my demo back. So I'm digitizing all that stuff. That's so amazing. I can tell a story later on. But we listened to Lord Finesse, and he said, Stu was like, should we sign him? I'm like, yeah, sign him. So Lord Finesse was the first artist I produced outside of Gangstar, and he became my label mate. And Lord Finesse brought Diamond D. Mm-hmm. He said, I gotta have my homies from my block. He brought Diamond, he brought Showbiz, and he brought Fat Joe and AG. He brought all of them around. So wow. That's how I met them. This is 89.
Wow. And you were supposed to produce Fat Joe's project, or the Terror Squad project. What was it that?
No, he signed he signed me to Terror Squad. Uh-huh. And we were supposed to do a project, kind of like what I did with this, like a compilation album, like the way Khaled does albums, okay. His features. And but then when Fat Joe left, I had it in my contract that if he leaves, I can leave. Cause they wanted it to where even if Joe leaves and goes somewhere else, we still got to keep you at the label. And I wanted the freedom to bounce if Joe bounced. So the first single I was going to drop was a 50 Cent record.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And this is when everybody wasn't really messing with Fifth to the fullest because, you know, he was having so much drama from after doing How to Rob. Mm-hmm. And me and Fifth hit it off right away and clicked when I got on the phone with him. He said he'll do the record. And right when it's about the time to do the record, boom, we get a call. And Fifth can't do it. I'm like, why not? They're like, he's about to sign to Eminem and Dr. Dre. And I'm like, no, because they already committed to us. And they're like, nah. And I talked to Dre. Dre was like, Preem, I love you, but he's not doing any more recording until he does his debut album. Not his debut, because obviously Power of the Dollar is the debut, but sign to them, get rich or die trying, and look what happened.
Wow.
You know, me, I always tell Fifth, you still owe me that track. So.
I'm sure you do. I think he's going to do one last album.
Yeah, I need
album.
You, Fifth. What's up?
I was going to ask, when you and Guru first met, how was it? Because, you know, you're coming from Houston, mm-hmm. him coming from Boston,
yeah.
different slangs, different sounds. Mm-hmm. How did y'all connect?
Just phone calls. And actually, it was during the new music seminar. So everybody was in town. And I was just starstruck. There goes Ice-T. There goes Chuck and Flav. And, you know, just everybody. You know, going to the battle, the DJ battle and the MC battle. And then we went to the World. They had a showcase. It was a lot of showcases. Mm-hmm. And the showcase, I remember it was Ice Cream Tea. Remember her from, it was a Strong City record. Shout out to Jazzy J. And it was Ice Cream Tea and Busy B. That's when Suicide was out. And I remember he brought Melly Mel on to rock on stage with him. And he was like, when I was a young boy, and Melly Mel was flexing. I was like, wow, it's Melly Mel. And then Kool G Rap and Polo performed after that.
Wow, that's.
And for me at that time, when Road to the Riches was out. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, I gotta be here. I gotta get on. And I remember my father was like, hey, if you're gonna stay out there and not finish school, please make a name that people remember. He said, I'm counting on you to keep our name hot. And I was like, all right, I'm gonna definitely do it. You'll see. And me and Guru would just talk about everything we had in common, the artists we liked, mm-hmm. you know, smoking blunts, you know, just everything mm-hmm. was just so exactly in sync.
Now I was gonna ask with B.I.G. and Jay-Z, mm-hmm. how did you develop those relationships? I know you talked about it before, but
right.
in depth. And also with like One in a Million and the beats changing, mm-hmm. you know, did he always agree with that, or was he like, I don't know? So talk about that, the first call when you got in the studio with Big, and who called?
Well, with Big, we lived right down the block from him. That's how we met. Mm-hmm. Guru was the one that's going, yo, you got to check out this guy, Biggie Smalls. And it wasn't Big, you know, it wasn't Big, it was just Biggie Smalls. And I got to credit Mr. C, because Mr. C lived down the block from us. And there was a weed spot down near where he lived at the time that had just opened. And any time back then in those days, since we were all promoting, getting lifted, you would go to the new spot. Hopefully they got some good, you know. Mm-hmm. So every time we went to the spot, we'd either go down the block that where C lived about his church, or and make the so we could park somewhere away from the spot, go get our stuff and move on. And every time I'd see Mr. C, he'd go, yo, Biggie Smalls, when you gonna listen to that demo? And I was like, yo, I'm gonna listen to it. Brushed it off.
Right.
Going to the spot again. You know, and we're rolling. Mr. C just happened to always be outside. Mm-hmm. Yo, Biggie Smalls. And he would do that every time, Biggie Smalls. And we're just like, okay. Chilling at the crib, because we lived in Branford Marcellus' crib on Washington between Lafayette and Green, because he was moving out and he wanted somebody to rent the brownstone. He was trying to sell it, but he said, just somebody to rent it. Me and Guru moved in together and rented it. So every day, pretty much, I was going to say every weekend, but every day, we always going to buy 40s. And we'd go to Fulton in Washington, where Big and them always hanging out. So Guru's like, you got to check out this dude, Biggie Smalls. I'm like, yo, C been pressing me about that. All right, I'm going to go with you. I go down to the corner. That's why the documentaries they've done on him. I said he had on the green army jacket and the hat. That's what he had on. And I'd go down there. We met the whole Junior Mafia. We met Kim, Chico, Nino, Del Vec, Klep, D-Rock, Gutter, everybody. They'd be there every day just on that corner. We'd drink 40s together, smoke together. And as that built, he was like, yo, Puff is interested in signing me. He hadn't even signed him yet. And I was like, yo, go with Puff. He's going to blow you up. Look what he did with Uptown and Jodeci and all that. He's like, but I want to get signed now. Why can't you sign me? I'm like, dude, he's already in a different pocket. We're just good on a certain level. We're not even platinum artists to even be able to sign you like that. And I was like, Puff going to put you where you need to be. And as time passed, I remember I met Mark Pitts, his manager. He was like, yo, you think this guy should sign with this guy for management? I was like, yo, Mark kind of a little bit resembles
Puff. Yeah, he looks like him.
Yeah, just a little bit. I said, give him a shot. I mean, if it don't work, you fire him. Then next thing you know, Gooch is his manager, and we all were cool. And so as it built up, we were one of the first ones to get his demo, the Big Mac, the cassette.
Yeah, Craig Mack and Big Mac.
At that time, remember, it wasn't Warning. It was called Hot Butter Soul because they, you know, from the record that Easy Mo B sampled. So that's how early it was to hear Warning. And all his homies had it. The whole Junior Mafia had it, because back then in the 90s, you know, you want your friends to already have your stuff before it drops. You know, now we're afraid of leaks.
Yeah, you don't want anybody to
have it. But your team, you want them knowing, and they knew the words to everything. And so from there, as he updated it and started finishing up Ready to Die, he was dropping Juicy as a single, and he said he's one song shy of just having a street record for the streets.
Ten Crack Commandments.
No, Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Yeah. Crack Commandments
the next
was Life After Death.
Unbelievable. Okay.
So from there, I told him that I don't have time to do it right now. And I was like, man, maybe next time on your next album. And he goes, yo, man, it's the last one. And he said, my budget's already run over. I got $5,000. At that time, I was making... like 20 a track.
You were like $5,000.
I was like, but Big was such the homie. I was like, I'll do it for $5,000. I said, I don't know what I'm gonna come up with, because everybody knows I make my songs on the spot. He goes, I don't care what you use. I don't care if it's in piece of present, whatever. I'm coming up. He comes to D&D. I cook it right there on the spot. He's the one that told me to do all the boop 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 and all the different things. I did it to his instruction, you know, which I don't like people telling me to. But Big always had his stuff mapped out on how he wants to do it. Did the record, boom, we turn it in. And I've told this story before, where I'm driving, and I know this is power, so it was on another station.
You can say facts, okay. It's all good.
We're riding, and this is maybe 2 days after. We're rolling, and we hear it blasting out of somebody's car. We get about to get on the Brooklyn Bridge over by all the courthouses. And, you know, it's almost like a dead end. You have to make the left to get on the bridge. As soon as we're trying to pull up, I'm trying to get up on the guy before he can get past me, because once you're on the bridge, you might go too fast. Now I can't be going, yo! So right when we're about to make the left, I pull up on him. I go, yo, where you get that from? He goes, it's on I-97. Flex is playing it right now. And I go, wow. And I was like, we just made an acetate. Flex had the acetate, you know, which, you know what acetate is? It's a dub plate. you know what a dub plate is?
It's like a real thick record that you shouldn't really be DJing with. You know what I mean? Every time you play it, the quality gets worse and worse and worse.
Right. And it's really just to test out a song when you get something mastered. So, they'll give you a dub plate just to test it and play it on a turntable. If you like it, then they start pressing the massive copies of vinyl.
Ooh, times have changed.
Yeah, and well, Jamaican.
Yeah, that's why I know dub plates.
Yeah, the same thing. It's just they'll do the 10-inch ones that are smaller. You can play them a lot more times. And it's an instant record just right there. You put it on a thing called a cutting lathe, put it on there, run the song, and you already have, and you can play it right away, you know, before taking it to a plant. So to have a dub plate on a 12-inch, like you said, you can't even wind it back. It's that heavy. You got to kind of just push it.
Yeah, just push it.
Yeah. Yeah, so hearing that, and they said, yeah, Flex got the it's called an acetate. And he said, Flex got the acetate. So I was like, wow, man, it might pop off. And next thing you know, Unbelievable was just summertime, that and Juicy together.
And now what about Hov? How did you do Hov and you know, some of your projects with him?
Jay, with A Million and One Questions, the crazy thing is, he called me and said, I want to do this song that intros In My Lifetime Volume 1. He did the rhyme over the phone and said, just like he did with The Evils, he did the rhyme over the phone and said, I want these scratches here, and I did the scratches to his instruction. Same thing with A Million and One. He said, he didn't tell me the scratches. He just said, I wanted to go into another song that's going to be called Rhyme No More. He said, but I need you to think like this. When I say motherfuckers can't, you got to have something that just jumps out when I say Rhyme No More. And he said, so split them. He said, those little breakdowns you do, do a breakdown so we can weave them together as one song. I said, okay, got it. I go to D&D to start cooking the first one. Jay walks in with Too Short. And I'm like, oh, shit, Too Short's in D&D? Right. You know, which we had been knowing each other for years already because of Gangstar's history. But see, you know, coming to D&D was like a big deal, especially for the streets. And Short was there to do a week ago. So they were in Run Room working on that. And Jason, he said, when you get the first half, let me know. I'll just come in and record it. Got the first half. Yo, come listen. Him and Too Short come in there and listen. I said, you ready? And now, for some reason, Leah, One in a Million, which is one of my favorite Timbaland produced songs, just came to my mind just on some DJ shit. And I put it in. He didn't have that. He didn't know I was going to do that part. Loved it right away. Said, turn the mic on. Cut that one. I'm going back in there with Short. I work on Round No More. Got it. And when I come in there, Jace, I say, I got it. He says, do not press that play button until I say, because I got to make sure it's the right vibe. He said, I'm going to say motherfuckers can't, and then you hit it. I said, all right, and I'm just waiting. He goes, motherfuckers can't. And he was like, oh, that's it. And he said, turn the mic on and cut it. So that's one of my favorite records because of like the story I'm telling y'all was dope. And Too Short was there to witness it. And it's just that was just an amazing thing. And, you know, Jay always came and got me for whatever, for every album. So
out of all the artists that you worked with, who is probably the most amazing in the studio? Who's your top three, if you can only name three? As far as you're surprised with the way they write or how they do it or how they record or how professional they are, their ideas.
I got to say KRS-One for sure, because for him giving me the opportunity when I wasn't really producing a lot of artists on his level, he reached out to me and said, I'm doing this new album, Return of the Boom Bap. Or like KRS, I'm doing a new album, Return of the Boom Bap. You know, he talks to you the same way, like, you know, like he's lecturing you and shit. And I was like... so that was just a dope opportunity, and that was 92. That was when I started to be confident that anybody that calls me, I'm in. I could produce anybody. Guru, I always put number one because I could experiment with beats that other people would definitely not take, like Robin Hood Theory on the Moment of Truth album. Always loved the beat. I knew he'll mess with it, and he did write a dope rhyme to it. And KRS, Guru. Man, because Jay was fun, Big was fun. Nas is another one that was fun just because he always visualized what he wants, especially when I Gave You Power. I want to do a song like if I was a gun and somebody like found it and picked it up and misused it. And already I'm just like, and this is after we done New York State of Mind and all that stuff. So with that, I was like, that would be crazy to do a record like that. And look what it turned out to be. At the time, it was called Gun. And then we changed it to I Gave You Power because he said he didn't want it to just say Gun on the track listing when he did it. But, yeah, he was... I don't want to keep saying, you know, Biggie J and Nas, but they were all fun sessions. Gotcha. You know what I'm saying? They were really fun sessions. And a lot of laughing, a lot of bottles everywhere, and a lot of trees.
Now, you also did a Gangstar album not that long ago. So can you talk about the process of that? Because clearly you had some vocals or able to get your hands on some things. I know that was a whole process for you.
Yeah, I bought vocals from his business partner. You know, I don't like to say his name because we just don't click. Mm-hmm. And the crazy thing is, I'm Pro Tools savvy, but not to the degree where I see the part where you can check date created. And when you look at some of the dates created, some of the stuff I bought were not from the era of when they would have been recording. They were someone from 99, 2000. We didn't, none of us knew that guy then.
Oh, so that means he got those from somewhere. And
well, I figure when Guru was sick or whatever, plus his house burned down in some type of way when he was in the hospital, maybe. I mean, again, it's all alleged, but somehow they were in his possession. You know what I'm saying? We don't know if he got them prior to, you know, prior to the house burning down. Who knows, you know? But at the end of the day, we negotiated a price. I bought them. Did paperwork to make sure everything was airtight.
Right.
I have good lawyers, which I'm sure I know you do.
And you're working with Guru's family also.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. We have a great relationship. His son is now, you know, 21, so he's actually in charge of the estate. He was always in charge of the estate with his mom. Shout to Lana. He now, you know, has meetings with us. He's into fashion like Guru was. So he has a lot of dope ideas, like, we should do this. And he's at the age. I remember when Guru passed and he was 9 years old, I was getting him, shout to Mosh, I was getting him certain sneakers made. And he asked me when he was 9 years old, he said, yo, when I get older, can I pitch into business ideas? And I was like, absolutely. And now he'll present stuff that's dope. Well, check this out. We'll, you know, check the companies and make sure they're legit. But he brings dope stuff to the table.
That's dope.
And we handle business with Guru's sister. Shout out to Trish, Guru's son's mom, and also his nephew, Justin, who's the one that went on YouTube to expose the guy about all the stuff that was going on that we didn't know about because I hadn't seen Guru in a couple of years. So with that, once we all teamed up and started the business, I said, let me see if I can put an album together. And I just pulled it up. I had about 30, you know, unused tracks. Some of them were not the Guru, the flow and stuff that I like and know that's him. Mm-hmm. But the ones that really stood out, I'm like, that's one. Just started putting beats inside and matching things. And, you know, as a DJ, we do acapellas with beats and see if it flies. Put in my Serato, fly it in. Yeah, that's dope. Dump it, make a beat. And we came together and put out one of the best yet, which did very well for us, and it also fed the family very well. So
and it made the other previous albums just get more streams.
Yeah, thanks to J. Cole, man, because when we were dropping the Family and Loyalty, Cole was the one that's like, first thing he asked me, he said, how did y'all do y'all's promo back in the 90s? And I told him how we did it. He goes, do that. And I said, because we always drop a street record first, radio record second, every time.
Yep.
Boom. Maybe a week or two passes, we're getting ready to set up the single, Bad Name. Cole calls me out of the blue and goes, yo, that thing I told you about how you set up your 90s era of promo, don't do that. He said, I think you need to drop mine first. I'm like, yeah, but that's more for radio. He goes, listen, I have a fan base that has no idea who y'all are. He said, I want you to take advantage of that time with me to pop that off. And they might go, I like this one with Cole. Oh, let me look at these other Gangstar albums. Oh, man, this is hot. Oh, man, I like Gangstar now. Mm-hmm. So he said, that I thought about it. I was like, wow, he has a point. So we switched it and made that the first record. And it worked all out. So shout to Cole, man.
One thing I would say about Cole is shout to Cole. Cole is a student to the game. It doesn't matter how much money Cole has, how many fans. Cole really loves those conversations. Mm-hmm. Like the how.
Yeah.
How did you start to mix tape? I remember Cole called me one day, out the blue. And he was like, yo, Envy, question. He was like, how did you get all the records from your mixtapes back then? I was like, what do you mean? He's like, how did you get the songs? I was like, well, sometimes I paid interns. Right. I said, sometimes, you know, I remember we got a Biggie song. It was a valet guy. Mm. And the valet was parking Biggie's truck.
Right.
And Biggie had the CD at the time listening to his own music. Mm. And the valet guy stole it and sold it to me. Like, it was so many different ways back then. Yeah. He was like really into, like,
yeah.
I always wanted to know, and I love that. Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you, you know, we're producing all those songs from way back when you were early on started. Did you always get your proper royalties back then, or did somebody take advantage? Because you hear so many crazy stories of people taking advantage. Because, you know, you were doing Nas's first album, Big's first album, Hov's first album. Did you actually get all the money you were supposed to?
Yeah, at that point, in the 90s, because I never had an attorney. Like, when I signed to join Gangstar, I shout out to my man Lee Van Richardson, who told me, in Texas, and when he looked at it, he said, dude, contract is not in your favor. I wouldn't sign it because you're signing your life away. But I just wanted to be in a video. I just wanted to be on MTV Raps at the time. And I'm like, okay, I won't.
Sign.
You didn't even try to negotiate?
Nah, because
he was just so happy to be there.
Yeah, I know, but I'm saying you might have your lawyer look at it and then be like, can we change this?
Yeah, I just turned 20, going on 21. You know, you're just like, man.
You're thinking, if I don't sign it, somebody else will. This is my opportunity.
And I'm watching MTV Raps and all this stuff, and I'm like, I just want to be on there with people like, I'm buying you because I saw your video.
Right.
So, and even my father's like, don't do it. As soon as they were not in my, I mean, I think I signed the same day at my parents' house eating some lunch or something. Next thing you know, as it got to where I was having discrepancies about payments, and then I took it to a lawyer to look at it, and they were like, yo, this thing is airtight. You can't get out of this. Started looking for a lawyer a New York lawyer who was I'm still with this very day. Shout out to Mark. And he was like, I found a loophole in there that could probably get you out, but you're going to have to buy yourself out. I was like, I don't care. Like, they were interested in signing us at Chrysalis Records because we had done a record with Spike Lee from Mo' Better Blues called Jazz Thing. And Brand, that's how I met Brand from Marcellus to move in, and how me and Guru moved in with him. That's how we met him, because mm-hmm. he was overseeing the project for Mo' Better Blues. And so from there, Chrysalis liked our music, said they wanted to sign us. The majority of our money went to buying ourselves out, but now I had the freedom to just do how we wanted to do it, and we stayed with them all the way through EMI to Virgin, which was all still part of the same family, and that's how we finally started to get some gold plaques and things like that. But the best thing was, now that I had a really thorough lawyer, he's been making sure we've been straight from 1990 on.
So you got all your stuff back from the...
Not all the other albums. They're still over at Universal, who's, you know, it's moved around from so many labels. You know, everybody sells this stuff,
right?
Then somebody else acquires it, then they sell it.
I thought there was a rumor like after 20 years or something like that, you get your stuff back. Is that true or no?
It's in some cases it is. Yeah, like after a certain period, you can either buy them back, or they're just now yours. It's really what's negotiated on your paperwork. But we have already been like, we're gonna look into getting ours back, because it's been a while, and on top of that, we recouped all the time.
Absolutely.
We had, you know, getting $150,000 back in 1990 was like, we're rich. Right. We got $150,000.
Right.
Then the next one, $175,000. Woo! And splitting that with Guru and paying our taxes and living together, which was cool because, you know, but he's getting two cars. I just bought my second car. He's buying his third crib. You know, like, Guru had a crib in Miami. This is without us being platinum. Mm-hmm. And gold either. And that's how I met Zoe Pound, mm-hmm. all of them way back in Miami. Like Guru had the jet skis on the water. He had the crib in Valley Stream in Long Island. And he had a crib in Brooklyn. I was like, this is living. And we never cried broke because we always made money.
Right.
Always made money.
And you were also really cool with Rage, the lady of Rage.
Oh, yeah. So, she used to live by us.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Then when we moved into Branford's, she and Nikki D lived together from Def Jam. Mm-hmm. Nikki D, you know, Daddy's Little Girl.
Daddy's mm-hmm. Little Girl.
Yeah, yep, they lived together. I remember one time I met them because Nikki D was having her release party that Def Jam was throwing. We all went to the party, and I gave them a ride home because they lived near us. Chub Rock lived near us. We'd all see each other, Chub mm-hmm. Rock. This is before Big, but still Rage, and we'd hang out. Easy Mo B would always come by. The RZA would come by. The Jizza would come by. Mm-hmm. Cypress Hill came and stayed with us before they went to their first video shoot for How I Could Just Kill a Man. They needed this place to hang out. Our house was the frat house, for real.
Like, I don't feel like you see that no more. You don't see artists like that all the time. And it's like, you know, you don't see it anymore, mm-hmm. you know, which is crazy.
Our house was you know, remember Animal House? Mm-hmm. It was like that, minus jumping through the window and getting thrown out. But
right.
Our house was that crazy. You ask any of them, they'll tell you, our house was the house to stay at and hang out. It was party, 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 fights, shooting in front of our crib.
Oh, my gosh.
Everything.
And the neighborhood's so different now than it was back then,
too. People waiting outside the gate, and I'm like, yo, who's that? And we were all strapped back then, and we all just looking, yo, who's that? And we all kind of go out there, yo, what's up?
No, I just want to get my CD. You know, can you listen to my CD?
And, you know, next time, some other hoodie dudes out there, we're all nervous, like, who's that? you always want to give you my CD. It was always just somebody just wanting to hear them rhyme. You know, Blase Blase, you know, Out Loud and mm-hmm. P.F. Mm-hmm. Cutting. We'd all, everything on that song, Soliloquy of Chaos and The Daily Operation, all the names he said, that was really how we were rolling every time wow. we were making a move.
How was your ego back then? Because you're a huge producer, right? Yeah. Were there ever times that you needed something from like an artist and they didn't come through in time? Like how was that for you?
Nah, we were really cool with everybody. I mean, we had drama and fights just like anybody else over some knucklehead acting up and we would wild out, but never to where anybody had like some problems with us or anything. Mm-hmm. Like yeah, y'all think y'all hot, man, fuck y'all. Never. You know, the only one that was really a crazy story was when Guru got robbed for his truck at gunpoint, and they took his brand new 4Runner. This is when 4Runners, the new style was hot, mm-hmm. and they robbed him for his 4Runner because he went to the store by himself.
Was this Brooklyn, Queens?
Yeah, Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. Dude called him, took the truck. I remember we had to go pick him up because he called us to tell us he got robbed, and he's standing on the corner rolling a blunt going, arguing with the other guys on the corner, even after they took his truck, going, you know, this is fucked up, this is what y'all doing, right? You know, this is really fucked up, y'all. Some punk motherfucker, like, they could have jumped him and beat him down and do whatever. He's still like, you know, I can't stand you, motherfucker. I can't see y'all, believe y'all did this to me. And then the illest story, and I've told it a few years ago, we're still looking for the guys that took the car. You know, obviously, it was cell phones, were only car phones at that time. Because he had to call us from a payphone to tell us he got robbed. They finally see the guy with the car. This is days later.
So he's still driving around with the car?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
That's Brooklyn for
this
you.
This is how Just to Get a Rep was born. They're chasing after him in the car. Cops start going, burp, 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 you know, seeing all this high-speed chase. And they're like, that's our car. He just stole our car. So now the cops jump in to help following the dude, too. Dude swerving, and he slams into an ice cream truck and dies instantly. Wow. And that day is the day we said that we're doing Just to Get a Rep, and that's how the song was written that day. We went to Brooklyn to Such a Sound Studios and cut the record, and that's why we did it, because of that.
Wow.
So Just to Get a Rep is a true story. And, you know, he altered it, like, as we know, things come back, and it wasn't about stealing a car, but it was relatable the way he wrote it, but he wrote it based off of. And the crazy thing, too, is when he got the car, I wish we had these pictures still. When he got the car, I bought a Mazda MPV, he bought the 4Runner. We're in front of our crib, posing like, yeah, we got our new ride. Mm-hmm. And then we're at the precinct, and the car is all smashed up like an accordion. Yeah. It's all squashed, and Guru's standing next to it going. So we had the before, yeah, before and after.
Did he have insurance on it?
Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Yep. So, but it was smashed up bad, where you couldn't have survived it behind the steering wheel. It was that smushed up, but we went to we had to go to the precinct just to fill out paperwork. But the cops were there as witnesses, chasing the guy too, and that was a crazy, crazy wow. event.
And you had quite an ear for talent back then too, working with J. Rue the Damager, Group Home. Mm-hmm. What happened with Group Home?
Dap is out, I think, in the Poconos. Melakai I talk to all the time. I talk to Dap from time to time because, obviously, I got him to get on the Gangster album that we did in 2019. And they're all chilling, you know. They still get a lot of shows.
Right.
They've been going to Japan. And they did a Gangster Foundation tour with Big Shug, mm-hmm. Group Home, and J. Rue. J. Rue was living in Germany. J. Rue, out of everybody, was the most that learned the business from us, teaching him and seeing how we did it. Mm-hmm. From that point, he's got his own website. He sells his own sneakers, everything, and he just stays really in the know. He's That's promoting dope. Shows, and he's all his Instagram is really interesting in the stuff he posts. You know, so he's still the same J. Rue. Mm-hmm. You know, real mm-hmm. loud Brooklyn voice. Yo, Prang. You know, he talks like he rhymes.
But I was gonna ask you good. Know, with everything you did. Production for every artist, damn near. Now, you know, you see law enforcement using hip-hop lyrics in courts against mm-hmm. artists. What are your thoughts on that? Because we see it with Young Thug, we see it with Gunna, we see it with a bunch of other artists.
Yeah,
what are your thoughts?
They shouldn't do that because music is music. And yeah, some of the lyrics are harsh, a lot of them are real. And, you know, be it fabricated or not, you can't really mix the music in there. Leave that alone and just deal off the stuff you know. I mean, don't get me wrong. Some people do be dry snitching on their lyrics, but
right.
I still don't think it should be used. You know, if that's the case, rock and roll, they've talked about how somebody said, oh, the, song told me I'm with the devil and to kill everybody.
Yep,
and
yep.
Same thing. You can't use that for
Yeah, because we saw people go to jail for like doing scams, and they'll write a song about the scams that they did.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. Show the money in the video, and then they end up getting arrested, and then they use that. Mm-hmm. So that shouldn't be allowed.
Yeah, the music should be kept in its own lane. And
the evidence should strictly be based off of what you have.
Absolutely, yeah, not with the music. No way.
Now, who is your Mount Rushmore of producers?
Definitely Marley Marl was just a big impact on me because of the bridge.
I seen Marley Marl yesterday. How crazy is that?
Yeah,
at a restaurant in Queens.
He just revolutionized sampling on a whole nother level. Mm-hmm. To hear a record like The Bridge, and I was just like, how are they making it not sound all like all the drum machines we were using in hip hop prior to sampling?
Mm-hmm.
How is he doing it? You know, and then definitely the Bomb Squad. When you don't eat, your stomach just keep growling.
We can't hear it.
I feel like these mics picked up everything.
No.
So it's like the Bomb Squad. Definitely the Bomb Squad. What they did with Public Enemy was just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
I gotta say Larry Smith. You know, he did all the Houdini records. He did everything. Houdini records, Run DMC. Even from the time we heard Suck MCs, he said, Larry, put me inside his cat to left.
Yep.
And we asked DMC, was that true? He said, absolutely. Everything was really what Larry did. And, you know, doing all the just classic records like that. And you said Mount Rushmore's Foreheads?
One more.
So Marley, Bomb Squad. I always got to put Dre in there for just him bringing a sound that we didn't even know about until I went to college. And I'm like, who's Eazy-E? And, mm-hmm. you know, my friends from either the West Coast, it's like, yo, they put me on the Boys in the Hood and everything. They always just said Dre, Dr. Dre, and sometimes they would say Yella, you know, on the side. But mm-hmm. I always put Dre in there. There's more than the four, but I always put them in there because, you know, I'm a big fan of Rick Rubin, you know, and, you know, even, you know, from Knots and Showbiz and you know, even Pete and the Lost Pro. But for what influenced me in the beginning, definitely Marley, the Bomb Squad, Larry Smith, and Dre.
How do you feel about modern technology making producing so accessible? People using like, what is it, Fruity Loops?
Yeah.
And Logic, and it was a lot different when you were coming up and having to make beats. Do you think that the sound gets more watered down, or you think it's a great thing that pretty much anybody could be a producer?
I think it's just whatever works for you, because a lot of people ask me, which MPC should I get? And I'm like, the machines are useless without your mind manipulating it to do something. So it's just like, hey, I can get behind a Ferrari somehow, some way, even though I don't know all the extra switches. I still know how to drive a car.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? But and I'm a race demon, so it's like, it's the same thing. If I'm behind the wheel, shout out to my man Panchi of the NYGs. He always says, yo, you have two modes. You have driving mode and you have airport mode. Because I've had to rush to the airport right before the plane's taking off. And I will get you there.
I will get there.
Even if I got to go on the shoulder, hop up, I'm going to get you there. And you only have to go, oh, look out, look out, look out. You're going to be fine.
What's your preference personally?
MPC became my preference. I started out on the SP-12, just as 12 before there was a floppy disk. Then the SP-1200 came out with a floppy disk, and I stayed on that. And then all the way till 1992, when I met Eddie Sancho, who worked at D&D as an engineer that you had to hire when you just did a record. Showbiz was doing a remix for Lord Finesse. It was called Return of the Funky Man Remix, and they wanted me to do scratches. So Lord Finesse booked a session. That's how I got to D&D. He's like, we're going to be at a place called D&D. They had me lay the scratches. He said he had to leave. He said, can you get the mix and just bring me a cassette of the mix?
Mm-hmm.
I had my sound system in the MPV. I listened to it and was like, wow, this is knocking. Boom. I said, we were going to go to Calliope, where we did Step in the Arena, and because Queen Latifah, Jungle Brothers, Ultramagnetic MCs, De La Soul, they were all working there. And I was like, I want my stuff to sound more grimy and dirty like them. I did the first album there with Stephanie Arena. We just got our budget for Daily Operation. I said, I'm going to D&D. Never left from that point. When we're recording the last song, and we're about to work on Dwick. Mm-hmm. I did it on that. No, what Take It Personal was the last song we did. Mm-hmm. In the A room. Everything was done in the A room. Eddie was like, yo, the way you laying your beats down, you should use this. He said, I'm about to sell it, but this is called an MPC 60. And I said, I know what it is. He said, well, let me show you what it does. He said, it's almost like a tape machine without a tape. He showed me how the way I'm laying my tracks individual, and I was like, wow, I like this thing. Ended up doing that and did Dwick on it. But we couldn't book the A room. They put me in the B room. And I was like, damn, I want to do it in there. I've never been in there. I go in there, we do it, and just say, well when the room opens up, you can do maybe another mix in the other room. We mix it. Me and Greg Nice, Dub C was there mm-hmm. when we did Dwick. And Don Barron of the Masters of Ceremony, he came with Greg Nice. We did the record. It popped off. It was knocking. I was like, damn, the mixing here sounds better. And from that day, I stayed, and that became Premier's room.
The B room.
From that point, and I've been on the MPC 60 ever since. I'm on the MPC Renaissance now because of the computer and more memory time, but still I'm on the MPC.
Wow. You know. Well, we appreciate you for joining us. Hip Hop
Thanks for having
volume
us.
Volume 1.
Yeah.
Joey Badass.
This is our interview, Volume 1.
Rhapsody, Nas, Run the Jewels, Lil Wayne and Slick Rick.
Yep.
Thank you so much
about
for joining us.
About to shoot the video with Remy and Rap. That's going to be
Oh,
fun.
That's going to be amazing. That's gonna be dope. They were talking a lot of ish on there, too. You know, I like that, though.
Yeah.
They talk that talk. They both could spit.
Yeah, man. And that's why they're two different combinations of MCs. You know, Rap is to remind me of kind of like the Lauryn Hill mm-hmm. type of a lane. And then Remy is just Remy, you know. So
she going to talk that talk.
So we're about to shoot the video to that. That's going to be so much fun, man. We already got our how we're going to dress already mapped out. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be gutter.
All right. Well, yeah,
thanks for having us.
It's Primo, DJ Premier.
Yes, indeed.
It's The Breakfast Club. Good morning.
The hit movie Bob Marley, One Love, is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Celebrate the life and music of an icon who inspired generations through his message of love, peace, and unity. If you missed Bob Marley, One Love in the theaters, now's your chance to watch at home. Stream the hit movie now on Paramount Plus, rated PG-13. Head to ParamountPlus.com/OneLove to try it free now.
Black Tech Green Money isn't just about telling the stories of successful Black entrepreneurs. It's also about giving actionable and wealth-building strategies that help you protect the future of our communities. That's why we're pleased to be supported by State Farm Insurance. State Farm also believes that we must invest in our communities to achieve economic growth by sponsoring programs like the AXO, which rewards high school students for their academic achievements. State Farm believes that being better neighbors creates better communities. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Hey, everyone. It's our favorite time of the year here at The Black Effect. We're heading to Atlanta for the 2024 Black Effect Podcast Festival, and we're not going alone. Nissan is back as our partner, and they're continuing their Pitch Your Podcast Lounge at the festival, where you'll have the opportunity to pitch your podcast idea live and share it with the Black Effect team. So get those podcast ideas ready. And remember, you can count on Nissan to dial up the thrill in your adventures, no matter where life takes you. Visit blackeffect.com/podcast festival for more details.
There's two kinds of people in the world, people who love Health Aid kombucha and people who have never tried it. The bubbly mix of probiotic tea and refreshing juice is delicious and good for your gut health, with great flavors to choose from that you can't help but love. If you've never tried it before, maybe try a bottle or can of passion fruit tangerine or ginger lemon. Your taste buds and your gut will thank you. Look for the brown bottle with an anchor on it and try Health Aid kombucha today.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft and process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox